As seems to be our pattern these days, I will begin with the end of the last lecture. Eventually, I suppose, we'll catch up, but if we don't, we'll keep meandering along getting through the material. So last time we were talking about the environment, and specifically about a range of issues, a range of explanations for why we are in the midst of what is variously called an environmental crisis or a potential environmental catastrophe. And I suggested that there are five kinds of explanations that are typically invoked around these issues. And we got through most of the first two. Individual lack of concern for the environment and free riding. Negative externalities of private choices and profit-making firms. And that's where we were when we ran out of time last time. I will be revisiting many times in different contexts this issue of negative externalities. And I'm sure for some of you it'll seem very repetitive. I keep saying the same thing over and over. There are various ideas that you encounter in your academic life, in this case in a sociology course, where every time you really think about it, you understand more nuances about the character of this concept and how it applies, a particular concept, and how it applies in many different contexts. So when I keep repeating certain things like free riding and negative externalities across different contexts, the hope is that you gradually develop a more subtle, multi-dimensional view as to what's actually going on when these ideas are invoked, so that you can comfortably use them in novel contexts that you might encounter. That's why I'm spending so much time repeating this particular idea. So just once more to repeat the basic core point of negative externalities. A negative externality is any side effect of an activity that has negative consequences for other people. In general, negative externalities are nasty. People don't like them. You know, somebody is imposing a cost on you. Now, the thing about negative externalities in markets, and then in particular about negative externalities and the environment, is that they're not merely oversights. It's not simply accidents. These are systematically generated by the nature of the dynamics of the system. And that's why it's a matter of general public concern as opposed to just an annoyance. And the central argument I've been making about capitalist markets and negative externalities is that the very nature of a capitalist market creates large incentives for firms to generate negative externalities. Not because they want to hurt people, of course not. I'm not saying that firms dump toxic wastes into rivers in order to cause harm, but rather it's the profit-maximizing way to behave. It's the profit-maximizing way to behave to impose costs on other people that otherwise you would have to pay and would be part of your bottom line. And therefore, when other people are bearing these costs, they're essentially subsidizing the firm so it can sell its products more cheaply and therefore be more competitive. It's not a question of the firm simply doing the most efficient thing. It's not the most efficient, it's just the most profitable. There's a tendency for defenders of free markets to equate the most profitable strategy with the most efficient strategy, the best use of resources. And that's simply not true whenever there are negative externalities. Whenever there are negative externalities, the most profitable thing to do is not the most efficient. The most profitable thing to do is to displace costs on other people who effectively subsidize the costs of your products. And that is clearly inefficient. One of the most notorious examples of this was the pollution of the Love Canal, which was a canal near Buffalo, New York, by chemical companies over several decades following the Second World War. The dumping was for profit maximization purposes to avoid the costs of disposal of toxic wastes. The decision makers knew there were risks, but they didn't share them with the public. The result was extraordinary private costs and years of inaction before anything was done about it. What I'd like to do is show you a very brief interview Whoops, just a minute. One more thing needs to be plugged in.
I was sort of a regular housewife from New York City in 1978. I moved into this lovely home in Niagara Falls. It wasn't a spectacular home, it was a ranch, you know, three bedroom ranch with a finished basement. A short distance from Niagara River. I mean, it seems to Niagara River, 5 miles upstream of Niagara Falls. It had two elementary schools, it had churches, it had a convenience store. It was a perfect neighborhood. And so I moved in there with my husband and my little child, thinking I just made the American dream at 24 years of age. I mean, my parents waited so long, very happy. And then after looking at the law, Michael got really sick. Michael's husband moved in. He developed liver problems, urinary tract disorder, which required two operations to correct. He developed asthma, epilepsy. I mean, it was just one thing after the other. And I did not know about what now. Nobody told me when I bought that ideal home in an ideal community that there was 20,000 tons of chemicals underneath the school that my son would eventually be attending. And so Michael got sick and sicker and sicker, and I kept taking him to the doctor and asking the pediatrician, and he had no clue. He's like, you know, God gave you this child because you're one of these moms that he knows will take care of. He's like, no, God gave me a healthy child. Something is making him sick. It wasn't until I picked up the newspaper one day, and there was a series on hazardous waste done by Michael Brown in the Niagara Falls Gazette, and I looked at it, and it talked about 20,000 tons of chemicals underneath the 99th school and leaking out into the homes. And they had a list of all these different chemicals in there, and so I picked up my brother and looked at SUNY Buffalo University there as a biologist, and I said, wait, what are these chemicals? They say toxic chemicals. I don't know what that means. And he said, well, let me see. This one will kill about 1 million brain cells when you take one deep breath. And he went through this whole list, and I'm like, Wayne, Michael's really sick. Do you think these chemicals, and him playing on the playground every day, though he wasn't yet in school, could be making him sick? And he said, I have no doubt. And so I went to the school board and said, can you move Michael out of the school? By then he was in kindergarten, 1978. This is when the article ran. And they said, no, we cannot, because if we move Michael Gibbs because of the potential threat, we have to move all 407 children. And I'm like, yeah, you need to move all 407 children. We're not going to do that. We're not closing the school because of one irate, hysterical housewife. And I'm at home saying, my goodness, I said, it's just unbelievable. And then I started to go door to door to my neighbors and say what I found, that the city government was not moving, the county government shut the door in my face, the state government shut the door in my face, and obviously the school board, Dr. Wong, who was the superintendent of schools at the time, slammed the door in my face. And so I did a petition and went door to door and said, look, you know, do you have problems with your kids? I do it related to the school. But we never did have at the onset of discovery the problem. We never really understood the dimensions of what was happening at Love Canal. We truly believed that our children were getting sick as a result of playing in the playground or as a result of going to school there and playing on the playground. We didn't know it really was traveling into our homes and into our backyards and into our bodies and into the wild. The area where Love Canal was a new neighborhood. You know, those homes were fairly new. So there was a lot of land where you could have built a school. You didn't need to build it there. It wasn't like you're in the South Bronx or something like that where you have a finite amount of property available. There was plenty of property available and they chose that, and it was a dollar deal. Well, they knew that the property was contaminated. The school board knew that, and the city knew that. They knew that there was industrial waste buried there because there was a waiver that said in the deed, if anyone gets sick or harmed from our industrial waste, we will not be responsible. So they knew that. Whether they understood the depth of that, because we're really talking 1950 here, so it was a different world and different understanding, is unclear. Excuse me. But one thing that did happen is when it went to the Supreme Court, when the government tried to get their money back for the testing, the cleanup, the relocation of Love Canal families, New York Supreme Court decided that Occidental Petroleum, in fact, did know more, did not disclose that information to the school board, not making the school board necessarily innocent, but less guilty than a lot of people think. And so they were held responsible for Love Canal, Occidental Petroleum, to the tune of $197 million. Huge price tag. Love Canal is named after Mr. William T. Love. It's really quite a unique story. Mr. Love was an entrepreneur, and what he wanted to do was connect the upper and lower Niagara River through this canal. What he essentially wanted to do was move the mighty Niagara Falls, as we call it locally, onto his property. And in doing so, he could harness the dropping of water and be a zillionaire, because he would have this huge energy that he could sell to everybody. Unfortunately, he had part of the canal dug at both ends, and then money fell away, the depression set in, and he never completed his project. But, you know, he was an interesting fella to think, well, I'm just going to move the seventh wonder of the world over on my property, you know, really take all of the energy there and all of the money, and, you know, I could really be a good businessman. And it was really, there's some old photos of Mr. Love and some of his friends and colleagues, I guess, investors, actually digging, you know, with the shovels of the ceremonial dig, and they have these big old top hats on and these old suits, and it's really very cool. But that's how it got its name. I think because it was named Love Canal and because we had Coker Chemical Corporation, it helped us to get a lot of media attention because people would giggle about all of these associated names. So it added a little play to the story. And the canal was used for many, many years before a dump as a recreation area. People would swim, people would fish. It's actually connected to the Niagara River back then. So as the river rose, so did the canal, and it was fresh water, and it was quite lovely. What Occidental Petroleum Hooker did is they bought that land because it went up on auction because nobody was paying taxes on it. They bought the land, they dammed off the place where it met the Niagara River, they pumped the water out of it in different sort of, they dammed it off in different sections, and each section they pumped the water up, and then they backfilled it with chemicals. And then they would go to another section and they would do the same thing. Our understanding is the city of Niagara Falls also buried garbage in there, so sanitary landfill was a part of that. And we also understand that the Army, the military, I guess, dumped some of the Manhattan Project in there and some chemical warfare products in there that Hooker Chemical was making at the time. And there's like live testimony of people saying, you know, they were the ones who dumped it. They looked like beer kegs, but they had stripes on them. We had to wear moon suits and put them in there and cover them up immediately. So what's in Love Canal, nobody really knows. We know there's over 200 chemicals that they have found, but how much of the Manhattan Project, how much chemical warfare stuff, what kind of exotic chemicals are there, is really no one really has a real good handle on. And the other thing that's really kind of scary is that you don't know what chemicals are there that were created from the chemicals that were buried there. So, you know, when they mix all up, then what do we have? And what does that mean? And it's that reason that they decided from the beginning not to dig Love Canal up and do something with it, but rather leave it in place and see if they can contain it. I was actually shocked when I went door to door and started talking to people and asking them, do you have this problem, do you have that problem, what's going on? We had 56% of our children, this is a 5-year period, so we didn't go all the way back, but 5-year period, 56% of our children were born with birth defects. 3 ears, double rows of teeth, extra fingers, extra toes, or mentally retarded. Marry these 3 women who live side by side, not genetically related in any way. All 3 of them had children born with the exact same birth defect, which was the children didn't have a hole in the top of their skull when they were born, so their skulls can't grow, and obviously their brains can't grow. And they could correct it with surgery, but it was just, you know, those kind of stories when I went door to door. We had a 21-year-old who died of crib death. I don't think so. I mean, some of this stuff was just, we had a young girl who was 12 years old who had a hysterectomy due to cancer. I mean, it was just bizarre when we heard these stories. But we really looked at the health impacts. We found, during that same study period, there were 22 women who were pregnant at the time of the study, and only 4 babies were born normally. The other pregnancies ended in miscarriage with stillborn babies or birth defective children, high rate of urinary disease, and the list goes on.
So, Love Canal is an extreme case, of course. No one is saying that every instance when firms dump toxic wastes, they produce catastrophes of the scale of Love Canal. It's an extreme case, but it is not an exceptional case. A high percentage of wells in Wisconsin, groundwater wells that are used for public water supplies, have contaminants. Madison had a problem several years ago of high levels of contaminants that were traced to disposal problems in our water supply. Now, some of these things are probably inevitable in a complex industrial society, regardless of any incentives. So I'm not saying that it is simply because of this incentive to create negative externalities. Nevertheless, the problem of profit-maximizing negative externalities is absolutely at the core of the various issues that you'll encounter when you read about the environment that are concerned with the release of toxins into the atmosphere. And there really is only one basic solution to this, and that's regulation. Basically, the only way that you can guarantee any hope of minimizing these negative externalities in the environment is if you pass rules and regulations that make it illegal to do so, and then invest sufficient funds in the enforcement process and the monitoring process that you can actually make it costly for firms to do this kind of externalizing of their costs. Making it costly simply forces firms to treat these things as real costs. And that's because they are real costs. Making it expensive for firms, in a way, the way you can think about it is that it is internalizing these costs rather than externalizing. And then when a firm faces the problem, okay, we have to cover the full costs of disposing of toxic wastes, then they're forced to innovate and figure out ways of perhaps even reprocessing toxic wastes in ways that make them new sources of products, and certainly bearing the full costs of the decisions to produce the toxic waste in the first place. If they complain, if a firm complains that such regulations undermine their competitiveness internationally, if they make that complaint, the response should be, well, that's really unfortunate. You need to innovate in order to improve your competitive position, but you're not allowed, as a strategy of your competition, to steal from other people. That's not a legitimate strategy of competition. And that's what unregulated environmental costs are. It's stealing from the public. And we shouldn't gloss over this. If the only way that a firm can effectively compete is by harming people in the environment, by dumping wastes, by not properly managing its production process, if that's the only way it can compete, then it should go out of business. It shouldn't be allowed to compete by way of imposing harms on people. And that's what the complaint is. Now, of course, it's always possible that regulations get out of hand. Environmental regulations can be clumsy. They can involve too much red tape. But normally, you know, what's called red tape is simply monitoring the processes so that you can see what's being produced. So you have to keep records. That's what's called red tape. So it can be the case that the regulations can be clumsy. They can be ineffectively applied. So I'm not suggesting that there's never a legitimate complaint against regulatory regimes, but mostly the complaints against environmental regulations are simply complaints because they are effective. And by being effective, they increase the costs to firms, as they should. That's what a regulation ought to do. And firms complain about it because it undermines their profitability. Okay, let me quickly discuss the rest of the issues because I want to get on to the new topic for today. A third general explanation for the nature of environmental problems centers on the strategies of powerful actors. The issue here is not just that there are negative externalities, but that there are powerful actors, especially corporations, which effectively use their power to block solutions. They obstruct the solutions to whatever problems are being generated by their practices. They block regulations which would prevent the problems in the first place. We saw this already in the toxic waste example. Large corporations use their power to block strong regulation and to block effective monitoring. But there are other ways in which the power of large corporations affects the nature of the environment. An important example centers around energy. Many environmentalists believe that renewable energy sources, especially wind and solar energy, should be the highest priority for energy development. That is, at some point in the future, even if you think we're not in the midst of an energy crisis at the moment, at some point in the future, renewable sources of energy have to become more important because the non-renewable sources will begin to be exhausted. Critics of environmentalists say that these sources of energy, renewable sources, wind and solar especially, are too expensive, and if they were profitable, then the market would generate them. Let the market decide is the response of defenders of the free market. What the critics ignore is that there has been an enormous level of direct and indirect government subsidy precisely to those energy sources which are not renewable, especially oil and nuclear energy. It's a myth that the choice of energy alternatives has been actually the result of purely free market mechanisms. Energy development has always been heavily subsidized by the government. If you look at the total subsidies for energy from the US government over roughly the last half century, this amounts to about $700 billion of subsidy as of 2006. 50% of that government subsidy went to oil and natural gas, and only 6% for wind and solar. Those are transfers of public money to private developers of these energy sources in order to make it more profitable for them to develop those energy sources. Now, I'm not at all objecting to government subsidies to develop energy sources. I think, indeed, that kind of public assistance to develop particular kinds of resources is something that ought to be encouraged. If we are to solve energy problems or any other problems, it often needs very large subsidies from our collective resources. That's what a public subsidy is. But if you ask the question, why have these subsidies overwhelmingly gone to oil and natural gas? And if you add coal to that and nuclear, well over two-thirds of the subsidies go to those sources of energy. The answer to that question is that powerful corporations have an interest in gaining those subsidies. This is not the result simply of the free play of the market. Another example of how powerful corporations affect the way our public policies around the environment take place concerns the funding for the Environmental Protection Agency as a percentage of the federal budget. In the late 60s and early 70s, there was a sharp increase in the awareness in the United States of the need for regulations to protect the environment. And the Environmental Protection Agency was founded to accomplish that. For those of you who are interested, perhaps ironically, the Environmental Protection Agency was created in a Republican administration, not a Democratic administration, during the Nixon administration. By 1980, as a result of environmental activism and the activities of this agency, spending on environmental regulation had increased considerably to just under 1% of the total federal budget. Beginning in the 1980s, large corporations and businesses in general, I would say, objected to this government initiative around environmental protection and mobilized their power to undermine the agency, to block its regulations, to take it to court whenever new regulations were proposed, to delay, therefore, the implementation of regulations and to intimidate the agency into not even proposing strong regulations. It's not so much that the laws have been removed directly, although some specific regulations have been, but that their enforcement has eroded. Now the Environmental Protection Agency accounts for less than 0.2% of the federal budget. So just in the period where environmental problems are increasing, the amount of resources we devote to the agency whose mandate is to develop the regulations necessary to deal with the environment, the amount of funding to that agency have been eroded. And this is an erosion that's the result of the concentrated exercise of power by powerful corporations who have interests in weak environmental regulation. A fourth explanation for our environmental problems centers not so much on individual behavior. Remember, the very first one was the lack of concern on the part of individuals, but rather a crucial cultural aspect of American capitalism, capitalism in general, but I think in a particularly intense way in American capitalism, which can be called hyper-consumerism, or consumerism in general as a cultural feature of capitalism. A bias in the way we organize our economic activities to have economic growth depend upon increasing consumption and developing a culture of consumption. Now that's going to be the topic of the next lecture. The lecture on Thursday is consumerism, so I don't want to belabor this point here. But consumerism as a way of relating your life to the economy, that what it means to succeed is to consume more and more stuff, having an economy whose prosperity depends upon ever-increasing consumption, is itself a source of environmental problems. And we'll explore that mechanism. Why is it that consumption, rather than leisure, for example, is the central dynamic of our economic machine? We'll explore that on Thursday, so I won't discuss it further here. Finally, just a comment on the role of ideology with respect to these problems. Free market ideology, which is pretty strong in the United States, obstructs the solutions to these problems. A famous quote from the Reagan years, the government is the problem, not the solution. And if that's true, as a general matter, and this is what a free market ideology suggests, governments don't solve things, markets solve problems. If that's true, then you can't look to the government as a way to deal with these environmental problems. The faith in the market and the belief that government regulations intensify problems, not solutions, blocks our capacity to deal with these issues. All of the problems in the environment we've been looking at require a democratic affirmative state. The free rider problem requires government to change the payoffs of people. Negative externalities require government regulation to neutralize negative externalities. Corporate power as a source of environmental problems. A truly democratic state is needed to counter the power of corporate actors. There's no other collective entity in our society capable of countering the power of corporations other than the democratic state. And finally, and perhaps in the most uncertain way around consumerism, again, we'll discuss this on Thursday, government policy is needed to shift the priorities for the use of productivity growth towards a less consumption-heavy way of organizing our economic activity. Again, we'll talk about that issue on Thursday. If you have as a general stance towards problems in the world that wherever there's a problem, we must reduce the role of government, then you can't solve any of these problems. Now, the flip side, of course, isn't true. That is, the simply expanding government solves all these problems. Of course not. Of course not. A lot depends upon precisely what it is that we ask the government to do and how we design those policies. The argument here is therefore not for a big government with a capital B and a capital G. It's not arguing for some Leviathan state that controls everything. It is arguing for a democratic affirmative state, a state capable of translating our collective needs and our collective interests into nimble policies capable of regulating and counteracting these negative forces. And in the last part of the course, when we discuss democracy, we'll explore ways in which that might be possible. Okay, new topic. And I'm going to